Well, it is a delight for me to be here tonight. I count the Irish Baptist College as my home in some senses, not literally my home, but certainly my home as far as study is concerned, and Irish Baptist Churches is my home group of churches. I have fond memories of spending time in Irish Baptist circles, and I'm so grateful for the way that the church has received me once I finished college, and it was just great. I want to draw your attention for a few minutes tonight to this passage in Acts chapter 11. The book of Acts, I'm going to take my jacket off, I hope you'll not be offended, it probably breaks every homiletical rule in the book. The book of Acts is a two-volume work written by Luke. The second volume of his two-volume work is really focused on the advance of the gospel in the first century. And the advance of the gospel as it moves out from its base in Jerusalem and as it reaches the epicenter of the first century Roman world, the imperial city itself, from where it will just go in every conceivable direction. And so Acts chapter 11 is really a significant stop along the way, as we're told about the onset of the gospel in the city of Antioch. And that's what I want to draw your attention to tonight. What we're told in this verse, or in this passage that was read for us, that we're told a number of things. Verse 26 tells us that it was here that the followers of Jesus were first called Christians. It was in Antioch for the first time that these people who loved Jesus were called Christians. Now, I doubt if that was a name that the disciples would have used of themselves. I think they already had enough names in circulation to identify themselves or to refer to themselves. If you read through the book of Acts, you'll come up with terms like disciples, believers, brethren, saints. And the last thing I think they would have needed would have been another name. Neither do I think that this is a name that the Jews would have attributed to Christians because, or the followers of Jesus, because I don't think that they would have taken an Old Testament, a term that is packed full of Old Testament meaning and significance in relation to the coming Christ, and given it its Latin ending and allowed Christians ownership of that name. I don't think that the Jews would have called Christians Christians. I think it was the pagan people of Antioch who began to watch these people and in their assessment felt this is the best term to identify these people. This is the name that fits these people, because by and large, people use names that fit their perception of us. Now, I doubt that the people of Antioch knew much about Jesus. But what I think they did know is that these worshippers of Jesus didn't have any interest in the goddess Daphne, who was the focal point of worship in Antioch. Neither did they have any interest in the worship of Apollo and Apollo's pursuit of Daphne. And in Greek mythology, Apollo pursued Daphne, and Daphne resisted his advances, and her father decided that he would save her from her pursuer, and so she was transformed into a bay tree and dropped 5 miles outside Antioch, and a temple was built there in a beautiful laurel grove in memory of and dedicated to the worship of Daphne. And I think what the people of Antioch knew was that these followers of Jesus wanted nothing to do with that. They didn't want anything to do with the sensuality and the sexuality that went with the ritual pursuits of the priestesses night after night out to the temple courts, and where people engaged in all kinds of strange and crazy things. They knew that Christian men wanted nothing to do with that, and Christian women wanted nothing to do with that. And there was something different about these people. They talked a lot about Jesus. They talked a lot about this person that they called the Christ, They loved him. They obeyed him. They talked to him. They worshipped him. He was the driving passion of their lives. This person called Jesus, whom they referred to as the Christ, the person that was promised in the Old Testament. And as the people of Antioch observed these folks that were followers of Jesus, they said to themselves, Christian is the best name that we could give to you because you love this person called the Christ. You serve him and you honor him and you obey him and your lives are built around him. And I just thought to myself as I thought about that, what a tribute, isn't it significant credit to the folks in Antioch that they would earn themselves such a name? And my passion as principal of a college and my passion for you students as you study at IBC and as you leave, that when you leave, that people will know you more as people that, not just as people who know a lot, that your heads are so big and full of theology that you can hardly find a point of equilibrium which allows you to stand upright. My passion is that people will see that you are Jesus people, that you love Jesus, that you honor him, that you obey him, that you're passionate about him, that he is the center of your world. That's what I really long for students, that they would be Jesus people. Really interesting to notice that the Methodists were called Methodists because the young men who formed the Holy Club in Oxford, out of which the Methodist movement sprang, were so methodical. Or you think about Harry Ironside traveling in China. Everywhere he went, they introduced him as the Yesu Yan, the Jesus man. And wouldn't it be fantastic if a whole generation of students were leaving IBC and people were saying, those folks love Jesus. Well, I want to try and lift four things out of this onward advance of the gospel in the city of Antioch. I want you to think about this church with me and those involved in it. I want you to think about the exciting beginning. I want you to think about the encouraging visitor. I want you to think about the dynamic leadership. And I want you to think about the outward focus. So those are the four things, and I'll be as quick as I can because I know that you are looking forward to the tea. An exciting beginning. After the death of Alexander the Great, his kingdom was divided up amongst four of his generals. The most significant of them, of course, was Seleucus. And Seleucus was the man that founded the city of Antioch. So the city of Antioch had a fairly illustrious beginning. It was also a fairly important city because it linked the spice and silk trade of the east with the cities all around the Mediterranean basin because it was right there about 20 miles up the river Orontes, just off the Mediterranean basin. And so it was well placed to act as this kind of service point, linking the east with the west. By the time of Acts chapter 11, it was the third largest city in the world. It's estimated that it had half a million people, 500,000 people lived in Antioch. And in first century terms, that's a lot of people. Can you imagine for 1 minute the infrastructure in first century terms that would be required to have this many people living in the same geographical location? That is a big city. It enjoyed a fairly pleasant setting. As I said, 20 miles up the coast, up a little river. It was a cosmopolitan city, 5 different cultures represented in Antioch, Romans, Greeks. There were Arabs, Semitic people. Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us 25,000 Jews lived in Antioch and people from as far east as Persia. So it was a cosmopolitan melting pot. 5 different cultures, 500,000 people living together in this city. It was also a fairly busy place, commercial center, an entertainment center. It was famous for its chariot races. There was a huge hippodrome and they had these crazy chariot races on a regular basis, and people would come and watch people half kill themselves racing chariots. So it was an entertainment center. As far as religion and as far as pleasure were concerned, the Temple of Daphne stood at the center of it all, and this sort of ritual pursuit of the priest priestesses, which was a kind of a reenactment of Apollo's pursuit of Daphne, took place on a regular basis, if not nightly, out to the temple precincts, where they then engaged with these priestesses in all kinds of sexual behavior. So it was a decadent city. It was a dark place. It was a place where all kinds of strange things were happening. But it was to this place that this group of men came and believed with all of their hearts that the gospel could transform hearts and lives. And it was to this city that this group of men came and started to preach and started to set up Christianity Explored classes in Costa and in Starbucks, began to connect with their neighbors and share the gospel with their neighbors and just draw alongside their neighbors, and slowly and surely began to see people converted and transformed by the gospel. And the thing that really strikes me about these folks that founded this city is their gospel passion. You know, they were not apostles. They had no official direction. They had no award-winning strategy. They had never been to a gospel coalition conference in the States. They had no precedent to follow. They had nothing but a message and a love for the lost burning in their hearts. And this group of men decided, and women decided, that the gospel could make a difference in a place like Antioch. Now, other Jews, having been driven out from Jerusalem because of persecution, were going and witnessing to fellow Jews, but not this group. This group felt, no, let's not keep this to ourselves. Let's share this with the Gentiles and watch God at work in their lives as well. A church was born, and a church was established, and a church began to blossom and grow. Some want to live within the sound of church and chapel bells, but I want to run a rescue shop within the jaws of hell, said one of old. And you know what I long for? Students leaving theological seminary, whether it's here or on the mainland, is that they would be gospel-driven people. Gospel-driven people. That the gospel would grip them, that they would be passionate about sharing it, that they would want to bring as many people as they possibly could to heaven with them, that they would have the kind of passion that we see here in the church at Antioch and those who founded that church. And I'm not talking just about holding a Sunday night's gospel service. I'm just talking about thinking about a community and how can we connect with this community and how can we make an impact with the gospel in this community? How can we see lives changed and destinies transformed? Gospel-driven workers. And my prayer for you as you study at the Irish Baptist College is that you will develop a passion for the gospel. Here's the second thing. It's an encouraging visitor. It wasn't long before the church at Jerusalem heard about the formation of this new church in Antioch. God was doing a new thing. Greeks were being converted, and the Gentile church was on the rise, and the church in Jerusalem decided that they better check it out and see what was happening in Antioch. So they decided that they would send one of their members down to find out what was happening. So they sent this guy called Barnabas. Now, Barnabas was a Jewish man. He was Levite, actually, and he came from overseas, not too far overseas, but he came from overseas. He came from Cyprus. We know a little bit about him from the book of Acts. We know from Acts 4 that he was a very generous man. We know that he had a field and that he sold the field and he gave the proceeds to the church. I don't need the money. I might as well give the money to the church, and this money could be used in the advance of the kingdom to alleviate the suffering of my poor brothers and sisters and finance other gospel projects. We know that he was renowned for his ministry of encouragement. His name had been changed from Joseph to Barnabas because Barnabas better suited his character. He was just one of those people that lifted you out of the doldrums. You ever feel a little bit down and you think to yourself as you're going to church, I hope I can sit beside him or beside my friend over here, because I know that if I just have a few minutes with them, they'll just lift my spirits. Man, just to sit beside them as they sing and hear the joy in their hearts does me good. And I think Barnabas was one of those people. He's just full of the joy of the Lord, and I think he was just an encouraging kind of person. You ever meet people that just sap the life from you, Barnabas was not one of those people. And you think to yourself, oh no, here we go again. Barnabas was the kind of person that you just loved to be beside and spend time with. We know that he was a reconciler, Acts chapter 9, 26. Saul has been converted. He's arrived back in Jerusalem. Nobody knows what to do with him. Everybody is afraid of him. It's not that long since he has been presiding over the persecution of Christians and the death of Christians. He was responsible for the murder of my husband. I am not sitting beside him in church. Thank you very much. And he shows up in the church at Jerusalem, and it's Barnabas that takes him by the hand and brings him to the apostles and says, if God has saved him, we need to accept him. So we know that he had the ministry of reconciliation. And I think he was one of the best men that the church in Jerusalem had. And they sent him from Jerusalem to find out what was happening in this fledgling church in Antioch. And he wasn't the kind of person that they were glad to see the back of. He was the best that they had. And they sent him to see what was happening in Antioch. Now, some of the folks who founded the church in Antioch were from Cyprus. Barnabas was from Cyprus. Maybe they knew each other. I'm sure they were just delighted to see him. But you know what I think? I don't think everybody could have coped with what God was doing in Antioch. Because I think God was doing a new thing. These people who were being converted and being swept into the church did not know anything about the formalities of worship in Judaism or attending a service in a synagogue. They frequented the temple of Daphne. That's where they came from. And God saved them, and they wandered into the church, and they didn't have the lingo or the language. They didn't know how to express themselves. This was different from anything that Barnabas had ever seen in Jerusalem. I would be prepared to argue that. And when he got down there, isn't it interesting to notice what it says? Verse 23, it says he was glad. He was glad. These were a bunch of new converts. Some of the baggage of Antioch was still clinging to them. They had not been going to church all their lives. They had been saved from a life of paganism. And here's Barnabas meeting them for the first time, and we're told that he was just glad. Glad in his heart. Glad to see them. Glad to share fellowship with them. Just thrilled to see these new converts. His heart was full of joy when he heard them pray and sing and talk about the Lord. Isn't there something really refreshing about new believers? I mean, my pastor was telling me about somebody that got saved in his ministry from the Gorbals in Glasgow, and he'd never read a Bible in his life before, and he walks in with this huge Bible under his arm. The first night he saved into the prayer meeting, and he shakes the hand of my pastor on the way in, and he says to my pastor, did you know that in this book there was a man slept with lions and God shut their mouths? Did you know that? And the next week he came back and he says, did you know there was a man in this book who swung his legs out over a boat and began to walk on water? Did you know that? And he's just full of the wonders of what's in this book that God has given to us. And there's something very refreshing. And you know what I think? I think Barnabas was just like that. He was thrilled to see these folks who had come to faith in Christ. Just thrilled. Not only was he thrilled, not only was he glad, but he encouraged them. Acts 11, 23, he encouraged them to make their calling and election sure. He didn't give them a list of things that he wanted them to do before he would accept them. He just said to them, make sure you keep going. Make sure you keep going. Because he knew that the pull was heavy to go back. The pull to go back was strong. And he wanted them to press on. And he just encouraged them to keep going. And why did he do that? Because he's a good man. He's full of the Holy Spirit and faith. He's full of goodness. He's not full of badness. He's not full of grumpiness. He's full of goodness. And the fruits of the Holy Spirit, like love and joy and patience, are all hanging from the branches of the tree of his life. And he wanted these new converts to go on more than anything else. You know what I hope for you as students? I hope that you will develop into encouragers. In encouragers. There's plenty of people, not many Barneys around in the Christian church, is there? Plenty of people to cause Barneys. But not many Barnabases to sit down and encourage people. people that will just be glad for them, people that will just try and encourage them to keep pressing on. And that's my passion for you, students, that you'll develop into a generation of encouragers. I want to tell you this story. I met this man in my church in Canada, and he was telling me that he had talked to this gentleman, and so that's why I want to tell you the story. It was during the hippie days in San Francisco, and one of the hippies became a Christian, walked into a Baptist church, tight Baptist church, everybody's there with their suits on, and they're all sitting in the pews, and this hippie walks in with bell bottoms on and a flowery shirt and a daisy chain around his neck and flowers in his hair. And he walks into the church and he barefoot, and he thinks that someone will nudge up and give him a seat, but no one's prepared to nudge up and give him a seat. So he starts at the back and he makes his way down. Nobody will budge up and give him a seat. Dear me, look at what's coming into church now. We're not letting him sit beside us. So he walks right up to the front of the church and he sits bang in the middle of the aisle with his legs folded, waiting for the preacher to start preaching. And everybody's wondering what's going to happen next. And then one of the deacons from the back started to make his way across the back and down the center aisle, and everybody's nudging each other. Oh, Jimmy will fix him out. Because Jimmy worked out at the gym, and Jimmy will fix him out. But you know what Jimmy did? Jimmy came down the aisle, he shook his hand, and he sat down in the middle of the aisle with him, cross-legged, and the two of them waited for the sermon to begin. And there was just one person amongst hundreds and hundreds who was a Barnabas to that man, who knew that when he left church, there would be a huge pool to go back. Huge pool to go back. But little Jimmy wanted to be a Barnabas, wanted him to press on. And sure, he would get rid of the flowers in his hair and the bell bottoms. But even if he didn't, he had met someone who really cared for him and wanted to really encourage him. We need a generation of encouragers in the Christian church. And I hope that you will develop into that. Let me say a few things quickly about dynamic leadership. Barnabas was going full steam ahead in the church at Antioch. And I speak in jest that he's running Christianity Explored courses in Costa, not Starbucks, because the coffee was definitely better in Costa. And he's just preaching Sunday. He's doing sort of group Bible studies, he's running prayer meetings, he's having evangelistic talks, and he just realizes, I can't do this. I'm going to burn myself out if I think that I'm going to be able to keep this going. And so what he does is he travels north, and he decides that he is going to go to Tarsus, and he is going to make a bit of contact with somebody that he knew 8 years ago, who was packed off by Christians because everybody was heart scared of what was going to come next. Somebody who has been living in isolation for 8 years in Tarsus. And Barnabas decides, I'm going to get him and I'm going to bring him back and I'm going to work alongside him in the church and in the work at Antioch. And so he goes and he brings him. And I don't know what kind of a conversation they had when he got there. But somehow Barnabas persuaded Saul to come and help him in the church in Antioch. And 8 years is a long time, isn't it? And I don't know whether he'd been keeping tabs on what was going on in Saul's life, but they traveled together, and for a whole year they worked together side by side in the work of this church in Antioch. And here's the thing I want you to think about as you think about that. I think Saul would have complimented Barnabas. I mean, Saul, think about the mind that wrote the book of Romans. Just brilliant. And he could bring a dimension to this church leadership that Barnabas maybe felt he couldn't give himself. Just a different kind of character. But what I want you to camp on for a few minutes is this, that they worked together for a year. Think about Barnabas. Not only did he employ the services of Saul, but then he went and appointed three others. Because by the time you reach Acts chapter 13, there are five of them preaching and teaching in the church at Antioch. Not five deacons. Five people involved in ministry, in the leadership of this church. Now, we sometimes think about Barnabas as a real encourager. Oh, he'd be a nice guy to sit beside in church, and quiet man. He wouldn't really ruffle a lot of feathers. Let me tell you, Barnabas was a visionary. He was a visionary. He saw the needs in the leadership of this church and he drove it forward. And what I think we need in the 21st century is people with vision. Not just people that will sit and, you know what, when I left college, I was consumed with preaching. And I'm still consumed with preaching. I still think it's the primary calling of a pastor to feed his people. But I was consumed with it in an unhealthy way. And I soon discovered that there's a lot more to being a pastor than standing in the pulpit for half an hour or an hour on a Sunday. And somehow we need a generation of people that will be visionaries, that will think about how we can push forward and see the gospel advance into areas where it has never had any impact whatsoever. That was Barnabas. He's not keeping it all to himself. He's building a team. He's expanding the ministry. He's pushing the work forward. That's my passion for you as you leave Bible college, that you'll become visionaries, a generation of visionaries. Here's the last thing, and with this, I will be finished. I want you to think about the outward focus. There was a man in the church at Antioch called Agabus, and these are the days before we had the New Testament. They needed people like Agabus to bring them a word from God directly. So Agabus stood up and told the church that there was going to be a famine and that it would be particularly difficult for believers or Christians in Jerusalem. Now, he didn't tell them what to do. He just gave them the information. He gave them the facts and left it with them to decide how they should respond. And the church decided that they would respond by gathering up a collection and sending two of their leaders, Barnabas and Paul, to Jerusalem with this money. That's what they decided to do. Now, they had never met the folks in Jerusalem before. The only person from Jerusalem that they had met was Barnabas. They'd never met these folks. These folks lived far away from them. But somehow they had this deep sense that these are our brothers and sisters in the family of faith. And as our Father looks at us and sees that we've got five loaves and they've got no loaves, he would want us to take one of our loaves and send them to our brothers and sisters over here. That's what our Father would want us as siblings in the family of faith to do. But my point is, and with this I'm finished, my point is, these people had an outward focus. The thing that kills a church is an inward focus, where we're consumed with what's happening inside our four walls. That's what kills a church. A church that is on the march, leaders that are on the march, are folks who've got an outward focus, who've got in mind much more than just what's happening inside. And my prayer for you is that you will develop an outward focus, that you'll develop a love for the world, that you'll think about our brothers and sisters in places like Syria and Iraq as they find themselves surrounded by hostility and some of them losing their lives, that you'll think about them, that you'll pray for them, that you'll begin to search your heart and mind and wonder, what could I do to help them? And that you'll motivate others to think about the needs of the world that we are in, and that we won't be introspective. Sometimes it's all so terribly introspective, isn't it? It's all so inward. But I think this is a church under the leadership of Barnabas that was outward focused. And I think, certainly in my observations, churches that are on the advance with the gospel are churches that are outward focused, and leaders that are on the advance with the gospel are leaders that have an outward focus. So the things we looked at tonight were very simple, weren't they? We thought about the exciting beginning. Gospel-driven people said, this might be a decadent city, it might be a big city, but we think the gospel could change lives here. An encouraging visitor. Barnabas comes from Jerusalem, he meets these people, he's never seen anything like this before in his life, and he's glad, and he encourages them to keep pressing on, because he's a good man. He's full of the Holy Spirit, and he's full of faith. But the dynamic leadership, he soon gets to a point where he can't cope, and he brings in Saul, and then he brings in others, Acts 13, verse 1 and 2. Five of them now in the leadership of this team. This is not just a placid man sitting in the back of the church minding his own business. This is a man with vision. And finally, this is a church with an outward focus. They're not just consumed with the color of the back door to the sanctuary. We Which might be important? Which is important? These are folks that are concerned about things on a global scale. What's happening down in Jerusalem? We should be. These are our brothers and sisters. We should do something to support them. Develop an outward focus and a love for the world. And I want to thank you so much for your kind attention and your invitation to be here tonight.